symptomatic redness. This episode is going to be, I guess, a discussion and to some extent a review of Panko's Mishra's Age of Anger, with me, Amog Sahu, and C. Derek Vaughn.
Mm. Yep, that'd be me.
Great. So do you want to start out? Or,
yeah. Sure. First, I want to apologize for thinking this book was going to be more coherent than it was. I just want to get that out there to our readers, because it's tons of interesting facts and parallel anecdotes and lots of history, and yet it actually doesn't have an argument. I'm coming out that right out the gate, because I listen to a lot of Mishra's discussions on this book on interviews, and I have read two of Mishra's other books, A Temptation of the West and a book he wrote on Buddhism, and I was actually shocked by how this book was not structured.
Right. Yeah, no, I think I agree with that. I mean, I guess I would just amend it to, there's an argument, but it's in order to make sense of it, in order for it to be anything coherent, it sort of flits between several different, radically different interpretations. I think that there is a sort of, I did have this feeling that I often have sometimes after listening to, you know, left podcasts, where a bunch, at least the kinds of left podcasts I listen to, a bunch of facts are thrown at me, and I don't remember very much. Like, I mean, I, you know, well, there's Herzen was talked about a lot. There was Tocqueville. Mazzini was really important. there's no frame, or there's no, I mean, there is a frame, but the frame is the concept of modernity and the discontent with modernity, and what both of those mean is, like, I actually have a couple of lists here of at least 15 different things that could be definitions of modernity, which are offered in the book, and another 30 different things which are anti-modern movements, which are kind of lumped together in the book. I think the overall effect is this kind of, like, slightly disorienting, you know, mix of interesting facts, as you said, and a sort of a grand history of anti-modern thought, of a kind that I haven't seen in too many places, at the very least, let's say, in the last 10 years, right? This kind of thread and this kind of focus. I think that the facts that he's bringing to attention are really important, but I'm not sure that based on reading this book, what conclusion I'm being told to draw. And that's the weird sort of, like, communitarian, like, liberal thing that he does in the last chapter about how we need to, you know, have better mediating institutions or something, and so that was my kind of take.
So let's systematically go through this a bit, because it's an anti-systematic book. What he is doing is he talks about parallels between anti-modern and modern movements. He keeps on going back and forth between the 17th century and the 18th century and the 20th century. He does state that the experience of modernity was kind of mirrored on the edges of France and then in Germany and Russia, like it was mirrored in the Third World, with similar outcomes on a much different scale. Mm-hmm. Although he kind of implies that, like, Nazism wasn't even the worst it's coming.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this kind of, like, mirroring mimesis theme. I mean, there are these psychoanalytical or psychological, what he calls climates of feeling, which is what he claims he's following throughout the book, right? I mean, he pays lip service to economic analysis. He pays lip service to analysis of of social disenfranchisement. But really, the central thread of the book is this feeling of ressentiment. These psychic hatred, nihilistic rage against modernity. Obviously the thing that, let me be the first to say this, that sounds a bit idealist. I think that problem, that problem will show up later when we get to hear what he says about Marx and Marxism. What he's trying to follow is thought. But it's not even really thought. It's not a sort of systematic development of ideas. It's a certain psychic dynamic of mirroring and resentment and sort of rage and hatred, right?
Right. So let's even be more specific. Yeah. So he starts off with bringing up the way that a lot of the comprador intellectua, which he calls Naipaul, and Rushdie turn a lot of people who were pro-modernization into anti-modernist because things didn't turn out as promised. And then he goes back and compares Rousseau's populism with its at first seemingly progressive naivete, but then later very conservative, stodgy moralism to Voltaire's cosmopolitan philosophes who ended up backing Catherine the Great and supporting the end of the Polish Republic. Now, I want to go into a little bit more detail about that because that's an interesting parallel, but what he then proceeds to do is go back and forth between different movements, and he'll jump times as if just pairing them side by side shows that they're related. Now, what's weird and destructive is he actually does do some genealogies of ressentiment that have materialist backing and even prove that these people on both sides were influencing each other. He talks about the way social Darwinism infects Herschel and how Theodore Herschel's Zionism does come out of Bismarckian nationalism and Darwinism, and that when Herschel first framed it, it was along ethno-nationalist lines that were explicitly racialist. Mm. That Herschel started off as a good secular German nationalist, and when the tide turned against the Jews in the 1890s, he completely inverted those paradigms into Zionism, and then he shows how a lot of Islamic and Hinduvada thinkers actually did the same thing. However, the fundamental differences of this are that he doesn't talk about is that he seems to want to have his cake and eat it too on whether or not these national liberation movements were progressive in the way that he sees. He keeps on condemning nationalism in the first world, but he won't condemn it in the third world. And he won't, for example, deal with the fact that the ethno-nationalism of Herzl undoes a lot of the liberal defenses of the project. And he keeps on going to Manzini and its influence on Hinduvada. But then he talks about how these comprador intellectuals were right to oppose modernization. He talks about how Rousseau is actually probably way more honest than Voltaire is. He doesn't talk about John Locke because he says flat out he's not as interested in English thinkers until you get to the 20th century. Although it would have been an easy case to make because John Locke mirrors Voltaire and Diderot in that he quickly, after the English Civil War, starts justifying slavery in the same universal human ownership language that he justified citizenship and emancipation in England.
I mean, there is, of course, Herbert Spencer, but that's the exception, I think.
Yeah. Herbert Spencer comes up because he's so influential on German and French thinkers and Herschel and the Iranian revolutionaries. I mean, at one point, he actually even says Foucault was right about Khomeini. Hmm. And that Khomeini had found a way to mix real populism with a Leninist mode of political organization.
Right. Yeah.
And he doesn't seem to be willing to stay in one argument long enough to see all the implications of it. For example, he hints at the fact that not only was Solzhenitsyn an influence on al-Awlaki and al-Baghdadi, explicitly they quoted him, but that Russian nationalism right now is also based a lot on those ideas in Solzhenitsyn, because it's returned to a sort of Slavicism plus orthodoxy plus defending a Christendom, not really New Rome, but not totally not ideology that Putin tries to maintain with a secular state. And yet, he won't really go to why that's a problem, except for some pop front liberal talk about mediating institutions after he's attacked Marx for having an eschatological view of the world based off of Protestantism, which is frankly weird. Hmm. I mean, he keeps on conflating Marx and Hegel, and he doesn't even cite them. He doesn't make the argument. It might be true that Marx has eschatological leanings in some of his projections, particularly in the early manifesto, but he doesn't even bother to cite it. He literally just asserts it and moves on. Now, you know, one of the reasons why you're talking about this and it sounds like we're going all over the place and speeding at 100 miles per minute is because it's a prodigious name drop at points. So I actually had to slow down and try to like outline out the arguments he makes in a chapter. And I don't think you get real arguments except for two. He goes through the Voltaire-Rousseau conflict, and then he goes through the development of German Romanticism and that dialectic with Gerbenau and French racialism and how it sort of came together in the 18th century. And then he jumps to Hinduvada, who used the same thing, and a lot of the same Italian thinkers who were all former Marxists who went basically and became fascist. Now, all that's known. None of that's a new thing. In fact, you can even get some of this stuff from Isaiah Berlin, you know, classical liberal that he is. So what is he saying at the end of the book? And it seems like he's trying to argue that there's a fundamental problem in the Enlightenment because it breeds resentment, but I'll be damned if I can say why. And all this globalization is new and making it worse, but I just presented a history showing that the ideas and markets were flowing between us being India and the Third World and them being the West, primarily Russia, Germany, and France, going back, and Italy, going back to the beginning of modernity in the first place. I mean, he was talking about Rousseau's reception in India going back to, you know, only 100 years after he died. Hmm. So what do you make of that? Like, what do you make of that incoherence? And it's idealist, sure. It's not materialist enough, sure. But why is it compelling? Because it is compelling. If you look at the reviews of this book, they're split. A lot of people say this is a pastiche with a lot of name-dropping that doesn't have an argument. And then a lot of people say, well, this documents the fundamental thing of our age. And what was really frustrating about it is he would just drop in the middle of a historical argument, a reference to Trump or to Durante without going into their history at all, because it sort of rhymed with something that he was talking about in the 18th century, but then he wouldn't explicitly state how it did other than this vague use of resentment. But he uses resentment basically as the primary thing of Enlightenment politics, a la Nietzsche, but then he doesn't seem to state whether he thinks that's good or bad. I mean, did you feel like he was trying to have his cake and eat it too?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess a couple of things. So, I mean, I think The issue is on the materialism issue. I think that the reason that I feel like pushing that sort of idealist materialist saw is just to sort of, Marxists will often say that if you're not a materialist, you're kind of analytically incoherent. And I don't think that's true necessarily, right? There are reasons that we want to be materialists as opposed to not, but that doesn't mean that every social theory which is non-materialist doesn't have a sort of like coherent theory story to tell about social progress, right? But in this case, I agree that he wants to have his cake and eat it, but I think that this squaring the circle about how such a sort of like, you know, story with such a large span with all these characters can be compelling is because, the way to do that is just, I mean, I think the way to do that is to say that he's making the broad outlines of the story. There's modernity and then there are discontents to it. Is right, but I mean the thing that he has to understand is that, you know, that means nothing unless you spell it out. You spell out what modernity is, which he does in about like four or five different ways, right? I mean, you know, it's unclear whether modernity is the idea of perfectibility. Sometimes it's that. Right? Whether it's secularization, sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's capitalist globalization. Sometimes it's liberty, equality, and fraternity. Sometimes it's sort of, you know, liberal hedonistic culture. And sometimes it's sometimes it's acquisitive individualism, right? All of these are different definitions. And your alternative to modernity, the alternative that you're going to prefer, is going to depend on your account of which of these factors is more important, right? And then we can talk about, well, what is the right progressive anti-modern movement, right? You could say, well, the problem with modernity is that it's white. Right. Yeah. And then based on that account, you get this kind of like, you know, bastard third worldist story about which anti-modern movements are good. Right. Or you could say, well, the problem with modernity is that it's too secular and too tolerant. And then you get that kind of story. The way I think he's trying to have his cake and eat it is on the one hand, he's saying, well, OK, all of this stuff is modernity and all of this stuff produces this, you know, even in his account of the discontents, by the way, there's lots of different things. And it produces all of these different dynamics. I'm not going to tell you which dynamics are more important or even how these dynamics relate. There's just this like broad metaphor of mirroring and ressentiment holding all of this stuff together, right? I'm going to say that all these dynamics are going on. But also, I'm going to kind of like, slightly flip between descriptive and prescriptive analyses, right? So there's so many places in the book where he's like, well, all I'm doing is describing this structure of feeling. I'm not talking about, you know, so to speak, to put it in kind of Adorno language, which of these needs or feelings are, so to speak, valid or progressive or should be addressed rather than dissolved, right? I'm just going to describe them. But then, as you pointed out, through the way, he shows, you know, his little post-colonial biases, right? Or his little kind of, anti-Marxist biases, right? I mean, this kind of incoherence shows up in the criticism of Marx, where, you know, you can, if you think of modernity in terms of, you know, let's say rationalism, right, in terms of the idea that there's, you know, historical progress, you know, and scientific analysis of society, all of this stuff, then, you know, classical Marxism is going to count as modern, right? But if you think of modernity in capitalist terms, in terms of, you know, private ownership of property, abstract value, production for profit, all this kind of stuff, then classical Marxism is going to be, you know, the loyal opposition to modernity, right? I mean, that's the sense in which I think he's having his cake and eating it. He's just flipping between different definitions of modernity, and then he depending on which paragraph or which movement you're talking about, he can basically, you know, pick what counts as the right sort of anti-modern movement.
Yeah, so we have all that together, and then you have conflations where he pretty much says that Hegel, for example, is the same as Marx, almost, yeah, you know, axiomatically, without any caveats.
I mean, tell that to Louis Althusser.
Right, well, you know, Louis Althusser's full of shit, too.
Yeah, but yeah.
Neither here nor there.
Yeah.
You don't fight bullshit with bullshit. Mm. But to go a little bit more deeply into what I mean by that, because that seems unfair, the relationship between Hegel and Marx is extremely complicated. The relationship between Hegel and Marx is extremely complicated because Marx maintains Hegelian methodology, but it is unclear that he actually maintains Hegelian teleology in his own writings. And to portray him as the uncritical secularization of a Protestant eschatological tendency without really proving it. I mean, that's the thing. Like, that argument could have a real pedigree, but you'd have to actually cite stuff. And he doesn't. The other thing that's frustrating is, for example, he talks about social Darwinism, but doesn't maintain the talk. He talks about Manzini and Darwinistic nationalism. He talks about proto-fascism in Italy and De Annunzio. I think that's how you say
his
name.
D'Annunzio.
D'Annunzio. And imperialism, but doesn't maintain it. He talks about how these anti-modern movements pop up and are explicitly drawing one another on one another, and yet can't actually talk about how they always oppose each other. Like, he's talking about how Herzl was an explicit model for Khomeini, which, you know, I want to see more evidence of that, because he just asserts it, he doesn't cite it. But B, if it's true, then the idea that these anti-modern groups hate each other becomes even more important, because they do. Hinduvadists hate Islamists.
Yep.
And yet he keeps on citing that they're coming from the same European thinkers, many of which are on the other side of modernity. You know, and he uses Rousseau as the analogy for them, and he seems to want to like Rousseau, and yet he also admits that Rousseau's moralism gets stodgy and breaks down.
But Rousseau's key to his Ressentiment story, right? It's like the whole idea of a bunch of at least his explanation for, you know, late 20th century and 21st century violence is that, you know, you're forced, globalization forces you into this sort of status anxiety, which makes you long for this like nihilistic break from, you know, existing existing liberal political and social institutions. That's the sort of Tim McVeigh story, right? And it's you need Rousseau to make a bunch of this stuff work. But then again, I mean, another point, the Rousseauvian and Marxian critiques of capitalism are not the same. Or if the Rousseauvian critique can even be called, you know, a critique of, like, capitalism in the same sense, right?
And he keeps on pointing out how these third world figures, particularly the proto-Khomeinists, the Iranian revolutionists and the Hinduvadists, were pulling from Herbert Spencer and Marx, right? I mean, he points that out over and over and over again. And yet, he keeps on referring to Rousseau. Now, the only connection that I can possibly see is through Soros. You know, with Soros is deliberately tends to reground Marxism in organic mythology, organic mythology and violence, as opposed to class solidarity. But he doesn't maintain that. It is a subpart of like the sixth chapter of the book. And it's damning because he's one of the things I think that you and I are getting frustrated with when we're talking about this is that he seems to be deliberately flipping between different kinds of reactions and definitions of modernity and secularization, and yet they are tangential to one another. Like, if you read Stephen Bruce's book, God is Dead, he talks about the survival of religion in modernity has pretty much, with the exception of some in the United States, has been tied to when religion becomes an ethno-identity as opposed to a religious identity, and it's no longer making universalist claims. So he cites Ireland and Iran and other things. So the tie between religious nationalism and ethno-nationalism becomes explicit. But he offhandedly mentions how civic nationalism and cultural nationalism were already existent in, like, England and France, but doesn't go into how they morphed into racial nationalism and the relation. Like, it's just, it's maddening because what we have to do is go back through and take an unsystematic presentation of a bunch of ideas in history, where he does actually do some legit genealogical work. There are kind of shocking things that he kind of uncovers. The relationship between Herschel and social Darwinism and Bismarckian nationalism is shocking. The relationship between revolutionary Iranian Islamism in the Shia context and Zionism is actually a little shocking, particularly given how opposed they are. The way Manzini is explicitly used by both anarchist and nationalist, that, you know, and if he'd have gone deeper, he would have found similar parallels in East Asia. But there are better, more systematic books on every single one of these topics. There's Modernity and Its Discontents by Stevie Smith. There is the myth of the myth of the Islamic world, which is based on a guy who also talked about the myth of the Pan-Asian world and how those kind of nationalisms come up with that. There's a book on how Tacitus was used as justification for German nationalism. I mean, he hits on things that are true, but since he doesn't sustain anything, we can't maintain this. Now, what I want to get to you about this is, why is this book so popular right now? Because I do think it kind of is, and it's not, like, hugely best-selling, and there's lots of criticism of it, but a lot of lefty groups are really into this book. You know, like, if you read, so, and I say lefty, not leftists, because we'll get into the what is leftist, it's leftist socialist or whatever, but, like, you can find a glowing review of this on Salon.com. You can find a pretty... Let me actually look at it right now. The New Statesman, which is kind of lefty, critiques it and says it doesn't have an argument till about 80 pages in, and it seems like a postmodern pastiche. But the other reviews, New York Times is lukewarm to positive. Let's see. The Guardian says it's a trenchant study of how modern societies produce their worst. The Slate says, you know, the Valiant Transition and modernity has things in common with Islamism, and thus this is a good book. You know, we need some transformative thinking between both self and world. And what I find about this is it seems like it's systemic thinking. And it does show you the way, like, Viktor Bakunin had, and, you know, Rousseau and Tocqueville had relationships to the founders of Hinduvada, Al-Aqawi, Tim McVeigh actually made friends with Islamists in Supermax prisons, even though he was a racist, but he actually kind of weirdly also thought that Brown Lives Mattered, which is really confusing, but was a true thing. He doesn't even go into, like, really weird things, like when Gore Vidal defended McVeigh on those grounds. But he does trace these things out, but he can't sustain them because he's doing all these equivocations and vagaries to make the argument seem like an argument when it isn't one. And what I've noticed is I think this appeals to a lot of left liberals because it makes it seem like it's about your attitudes, that if we just acknowledge the contradictions of the Enlightenment, then we can make them go away.
Right. I mean, I think I'm a little more kind of or slightly more optimistic about Mishra, you know, offering a Mishra solution. But I mean, in the sense that I want to convict him of a different crime. I think he just doesn't know what he wants. Rather than, you know, I'm sure people reading him have this aspiration, but I feel like the solution that he comes up with is kind of, globalization has created this world where individual people, you know, don't know their norms, aren't able to make sense of their world, are controlled by these opaque forces that, you know, that they have very little control over, or a mixture of, you know, the sort of grab bag of different critiques of modernity. And then what we need is this kind of political community, these set of mediating institutions, which are going to relocalize somehow. Because he talks about, you know, the locality of understanding and how human beings are these local creatures, right? So, I mean, the thing to say to that is, well, how are you different from virtually everyone you've talked about, good or bad? Right? That sounds like something that all of the movements that you've talked about would be on board with, right? And, I mean, obviously the audience for this book, as you pointed out, are left liberals, and they'll say, well, that sounds great. That, you know, that sounds like a recipe for greater dialogue between voters in McDowell County, Virginia, and and liberal elites, or something like that, right? So, I mean, I think that you're right, but I think that it's less that Mishra is a liberal, and more that, you know, he's recognized this confused anti-modernity, and his solution to it is just as confused as the categories that he's been using throughout the book, right? It's a solution that could appeal to any of these anti-modern movements, I would think.
Well, yeah, but he also doesn't want to condemn rootless cosmopolitanites with, you know, blue blood Tory wives, because he is one. now this I will say, this book is not normal for Mishra, and that most of his books aren't this pastiche, because he normally grounds it in his own experience.
Right.
If you read his book on the Temptations of the Rest, he talks about Chinese and Indian intellectuals and how they wrestled with the West, and he frames it in the terms of his own wrestling. And his book on Buddha is written about the same way, about his own relationship with Buddhism and its history. And all those books are grounded because they're narrative, and they seem to have an argument because they're about personal experience. And his, you know, anti-Marxism... Hmm. His anti-Marxism shows up, and what's weird is he's actually the weirdly, like, he has, like, Brezhnev nostalgia and Lenin nostalgia, but he has a strong anti-Marxism.
Right. I mean, this is the thing. There is a story in this book, but it's a story of this vague bloc called modernity and this vague discontent, both of whom are in this kind of fatal dance. It's kind of dialectic of enlightenment, but really, really blurry and really confused. And I mean, the thing is, this shows up because his anti-Marxism is a specific. I think there's some logic to why he has to be an anti-Marxist. Because Marxism has this ambiguous position in this story, right? Where it's simultaneously, it's the loyal opposition to modernity. It simultaneously has modern and anti-modern aspects, right? According to Mishra's classification. And depending on which aspects he opts for, Marxism is going to plop on either side of this. And Marxist movements, you know, are going to fall on either side of this. And so the reason he gets to like Lenin and the reason he gets to like Brezhnev is because, you know, oh, they're not committed to enlightenment rationalism or whatever, right?
But they sure as hell were. Yeah, they were. I mean, that's right. They're actually probably more so than Marx was. I mean, Lenin's doctrine for how you got communism was Soviets plus electrification plus killing all the reactionaries, and then we could have liberalism again.
I mean, he sees... I guess the point is that he sees Lenin as a national liberation figure or something, right? Yeah.
Right.
But that's not right.
I mean, he almost buys... You know what it is, though? I mean, you almost feel like he wants to defend Stalin, but won't. So he defends Lenin instead.
Right.
And he does so by reading Lenin in the way that actually anti-Leninist would read Lenin. I mean, like, you and I have anti-Leninist tendencies too, but we both know from reading Lars Ling and from looking at his policies, at least initially, he actually believed in, like, formal bourgeois whites and stuff like that. And from Lars Ling's
You mean pre-Civil War, right?
Yeah, and also he continued to say he was going to go back to that post-Civil War, but never did.
I mean, that's dicey territory, right? It's like, you know, we've been down this. I mean, you've been down this road many, many times about, you know, the it was just the Civil War excuse.
Right, and I mean, I ultimately found it as an excuse, and I also find the fact that Lars Ling won't really talk about the Civil War directly very long to be pretty telling. Right. But he's not wrong in that Lenin actually justified most of what he did, and traditional bourgeois rights. I mean, one of the reasons why he talked about democratic centralism being viable was that it was actually based in the bourgeois conception of freedom of association.
And I take it, I mean, I would certainly defend, at least to some extent, the early, that Lenin. My feeling is that you would as well.
Well, I mean, I feel like Lenin is not—he's not out of a Marxist tradition, even if things don't actually perfectly comport with Marx, and that Marx's writing on things like bourgeois whites seem conflicted. I mean, if you read his support of the Alfred program, or what would become the Alfred program, because the Alfred program really happened after his death.
Right.
And his critique of the Goethe program, he does seem to both critique these bourgeois whites as way too limited, but also seems to think that they're necessary and that a lot of socialists using them actually are producing less emancipatory things than, well, the bourgeois is, and he doesn't think the bourgeois are doing a very good job of it, so the socialists are probably going to do worse.
Right.
That doesn't seem to be something that Mishra can even deal with. I mean, like, he paints Marx as an unequivocal developmentalist. Now, Marx was a developmentalist in many ways, but it wasn't unequivocal. And you see this about his own ambiguous writings on the British presence in India and how he went from supporting it to denouncing it.
Which Mishra cites, by the way. he quotes from those writings.
Right, but then doesn't really, you know, deal Absolutely. With the implications of it.
Yeah. No, it's the paragraph from Marx's writings on India is here, where Marx is condemning, you know, how bits of India are ruled by Muslims and by Brits and so on and so forth. But that's to feed into this, like, nationalist story, right? It's not looked at on its own terms.
No, it's really not. And it's kind of amazingly frustrating. Now, why do you think Mishra's sort of psychological style has a lot of play right now? Let's go into that. Because when I hear him talk about it on broader terms, I actually find his arguments about the Enlightenment somewhat convincing. I think he does have an insight about, for example, well, Voltaire actually ended up supporting Catherine the Great and Diderot's boner for, you know, enlightened despotism. I mean, like, that's a very real thing.
Right. I mean, I guess here's the critique of Enlightenment, again, is a bit complicated. I find it compelling and confusing. I find it compelling mainly because, and this is true, I think, for virtually every point of the book, that, I mean, I've heard all of it before, right? The historical stuff you're more up on than me, but the philosophical points have all been made in many ways by people in the 20th century. People he cites, but a lot of this, I mean, this book reminded me a lot of kind of, you know, Hannah Arendt's more kind of wide-ranging work, where she just does this sloppy kind of like, you know, I mean, she's better than this, but she does a lot of sloppy painting. But most of the criticisms of Enlightenment, and this is not necessarily a problem, none of them are original. But what's good is that they're kind of collated together and they're played out through all of these different movements, right? So there's the stuff about this methodological individualism occasionally about like how, you know, we view the Enlightenment and capitalist globalization was some mix of the two, made the world increasingly into atomized, self-sufficient individuals who were convinced they were going to get status. And these are the people who, you know, once they realized that they couldn't get this status, began to start blowing shit up, right? So that's one kind of criticism of Enlightenment. It's a criticism of this kind of, like, view of human beings as individuals. And also, there's this kind of like rationalism, right? The Enlightenment thought that human beings were abstract reasoners. They thought that as a result of, you know, the fundamental rationality of human beings, that they could be that there could be a global society where human beings could become perfectly rational, free, equal beings, right? And then the basic thread that he runs, which also runs with the McVeigh stuff, is that, well, this is obviously wrong, and when you try to implement this, you'll get all of these monsters and terrors coming up, right? Which is, I mean, I don't think he thinks about the conservative implications of that argument, actually, right? I don't think he thinks, I mean, this sort of idea that, oh, you know, liberty and equality, abstract liberty and abstract equality implemented on Earth, is destined to fail because it doesn't take enough account of the rootedness of human beings, right? That's this sort of very standard Burkean argument, right?
Right, which he seems to, again, want to have his cake and eat it too, right, with. I mean, he keeps on referencing Burke's writing on the war in France and the terror of Robespierre. And actually, he's even more terrified by Napoleon than Robespierre.
Oh, yeah.
But he points out that Robespierre fashions himself a priest. I actually like wanted him to go deeper into this because this is where he's actually having insights that cut against a lot of liberal and far left, frankly, like romanticism about like what the Mountain and the Jacobins were.
Right.
Because one of the things that people miss is that Thomeador was a moderate reaction, but that also that Robespierre saw himself as a Kantian, almost.
Right.
That's how he frames virtue in deontological terms. Everything is justified on that. And he actually liquidates the proto-communist and the atheist. Because I'm like, oh, it's enforced secularism. No, it's not. He's starting a cult of reason. He kills the Enragés.
Right.
He has the Enragés killed. He is actually trying to maintain a more radical center than the Thermidorans are trying to maintain, but it's still a center and it's still a bourgeois project.
Right.
And it's still one where there's some kind of deist religion that is enforced by state mandate, and that it turns the wars in the Vendée from a political economic war to a religious war, which is why that's where the death toll in the French Revolution amps up, which also in a lot of current recent liberal studies where they say, well, the American Revolution was killed more people, they actually do not count the wars in the Vendée as part of the French Revolution's death toll and only count the terror.
Right.
Which is fundamentally fucking dishonest. So, you know, I wanted to, like, he keeps on hinting on these things, like, he knows them, and he, like, flirts with it for a second, and then doesn't stay there long enough to say it. Because I don't think he wants to deal with the implications of staying in any of these arguments. I mean, one of the things that you have to come to the conclusion of is he doesn't know if he wants to condemn, Khomeiniism.
Right. I mean, you say come in, just do that for almost everything in the book. I mean, why does he, in the end, what reasons has he given us for hating anybody? Modi, Putin, Erdogan, you know, or any of the...
That nationalism is bad, but then he actually is making the argument for nationalism throughout the book.
Right.
He says, like... He says that nationalism is always like a, you know, a catch 22 or whatever. A friend of mine who's conservative is like, who actually is an anti-nationalist, which is an interesting thing. But he said, but my conservative anti-nationalist says that's not patronizing at all. And it's weird because he's having his cake and eating it too. He points out the contradictions of Herschel and Zionism, but basically kind of defends it. He points out the contradictions of Hinduvada, but defends every reason they had for coming to those conclusions, but Modi and Putin must be bad.
I mean, it's fine to call nationalism a catch-22. Tell us why it's a catch-22.
Right, and but the thing is, if he does, I think he can't maintain his, oh my gosh, the Enlightenment is so scary with his internationalism.
Right.
I mean, one of the things that... he doesn't want to deal with is, and I think part of why he doesn't go into the writings of Marx and Engels that deeply on things like democratic questions, is that he doesn't know how to deal with the contradictions of, Rousseau's sort of the people, you know, populism, because that's just as much a part of Robespierre as the Enlightenment thinking is.
Right.
Whereas the philosophes support enlightened despotism because they basically think the elite should run everything.
I mean, if you follow his argument, you know, democracy in the bourgeois sense is abstract and formal and should be rejected. Right. Right. This is the extension of formal human rights to every member of the human race by virtue of their being human is just another example of abstract Voltairean Kantian thinking.
Right. You know, and you know, that's damning to him. And I think part of why he wants to have his cake and eat it too is he wants a coalition of liberals who don't entirely embrace, you know, Naipaul and Rushdie, but still pretty much are rootless cosmopolitans.
Right.
Well, that at the end seems to be a conclusion. Like he seems to say, I completely understand why there's all this reaction to all this. It didn't deliver on what's promised. We can't deliver on what's promised because of ecological limitations, which you and I haven't talked about, but he actually pretty much says that there's no way to deliver on the promise of modernity.
Right. Which is, I mean, I think everyone agrees more needs to be said there to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that could be a legitimate argument, but it's not one he makes. He asserts it and then moves on to these other analogous arguments. I mean, that's the other thing that he does. He does genealogies, kind of, but he doesn't maintain them, and he does analogous arguments. So that's why he's flipping back and forth between things. And he talks about one of the frustrations in Islamism that led to people like Khattab and the radical end of the Muslim Brotherhood becoming so influential was that the secular forces, you know, the Shaven army was so corrupt.
Right.
But he doesn't go into why it had to be corrupt, and he doesn't, you know, he talks about imperialism, but then he kind of misses that a lot of these nationalist movements were also explicitly anti-imperialist when they were secularists. The Baathists were anti-imperialist too. They are both different kinds of third worldism. He kind of condemns Baathism in that, by saying that Khomeini had more populist legitimacy,
right,
against Hussein.
Right.
He ignores that Nasser kicked out all the foreigners, not Khattab. Khattab would have been actually happy with the foreigners if they converted to Islam.
Right.
He actually doesn't actually go into the thinking of a lot of the third worldist nationalist. He uses Rushdie and Naipaul, who are emigres, to represent the thinking of Nasser and Ataturk.
Right. Yeah.
And then he talks about how, you know, Hitler really loved Ataturk, but Naipaul didn't know that. Dude, I think anyone who's studied Ataturk at all and studied Hitler at all would know that there's a relationship there. There's several books on it.
Right. I mean, I think another point to bring up is that even though, you know, I've been sort of a bit kinder to the book and saying that, okay, well, at least there's this sort of modernity resentiment main thread. Even that collapses if you think about it for a second, right? The key thesis maybe is something like, well, modernity produces, you know, disaffection of these various kinds, right? And then that disaffection leads to, you know, these anti-liberal movements. But then you think about all of the different movements that he's calling anti-liberal, and you look at the differences between them, you know, for some of these movements, religion is key. For some of these movements, they're explicitly anti-religious. The economics of these movements could be corporatist, or it could be more neoliberal. In many cases, it even could involve state, you know, widespread state control. Some of these movements are more anti-West or anti-West in different ways. They have different attitudes to liberal modernity. They could be individuals. They could be groups of various sorts. They could be nation states. You know, all of them target a hated other, but what the hated other is depends on what movements you're talking about. And you go through this list, and then you say, well, is resentiment a strong enough glue to hold all these disparate groups together? Right, and then you can...
Because who doesn't have resentiment?
Exactly.
I mean, that's the other point. Yeah. Like even the elites do at this point, which is part... Like, he almost makes that argument about, you know, Clintonites and whatever. But you get the feeling, kind of like you get the feeling with someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates, that he seems to think that, look, these people are scary. Why don't you have a more humane and localized elite who is more loyal to their base, because otherwise these people are scary? But he doesn't explain why that never seems to happen.
Right.
I mean, and his argument about globalization makes it worse seems to be contradicted by the fact that he's actually illustrating that globalization predates globalization.
Right.
That all these ideas were already coming across in markets during the colonial period, for Christ's sake. I mean, one of the things he keeps on, like, not dealing with, and, you know, there's the Gandhi chapter where he seems to want to defend Gandhi and, mm-hmm. you know, but, and I think this is where knowing India really helps. Right. I don't think a lot of people reading this know the context for how unpopular Gandhi is in parts of India.
Oh, yeah, no, Gandhi is very much out of vogue on the Indian left right now.
And the Indian right.
Right.
I mean, like, and he talks about, you know, how Hindu Vadist basically took advantage of that, but he doesn't deal with, you know, he doesn't really stay and talk about Nehru. He talks about how Nehru was introduced into the Theosophical Society.
Right.
But, like, and yeah, all this stuff is fascinating, but he doesn't sustain any of it. Now, I'm going to slightly defend the book in a different way.
Sure.
If this book gets you to explore these movements and ideas in a serious and sustained way, I think this book can have a lot of use. And I think there's a whole lot of stuff in here about, say, Zionism and its relation to social Darwinism, about Khomeini's ambivalence towards Leninism, about... the way Hindu Vadist explicitly used Italian corporatism and Italian cultural nationalism as opposed to racial nationalism, although he doesn't really say that, but that's definitely true with Mazzini, that all this is actually important. But there are big glaring holes that he would have to plug. He doesn't seem to know anything about Latin America.
Right.
Where there are things that went other ways that it's had the same problems. Like, he doesn't mention Peronism. He doesn't mention Brazilian integralism and its relationship to fascism. He doesn't mention the tensions between Hitlerism and fascism, and how Mussolini actually alienated elements of the fascists by adopting Hitlerism. He doesn't even mention that he doesn't really deal with the fact that so many of these groups hate each other, and that goes back to even the periods he's talking about. I mean, like, Evola, who was Nazi sympathetic at one point, actually critiques the Nazis for being not right wing enough because they're biologists.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just, and they're wiping people out for their biology, which makes no real sense. And I'm like, you know, and he just doesn't, he doesn't stay with anybody long enough. He mentions that, oh, you know, the predecessor, I can't remember his name, but the predecessor of Khomeini, he was highly influenced by both Marx and Heidegger, but then doesn't go into Heidegger's own relationship with the Nazis.
I mean, even if he did, that would just be, okay, another addendum at the end of the whole Hegel, Nietzsche, German Romanticism story, right?
Right. Yeah,
that's where Heidegger fits in here.
But he doesn't really go into, like, he keeps on talking about how Russia and Germany really model what happens, you know, and basically he's not saying this, but in Asia, because his other and the third world for him is actually Asia, because that's what he knows.
I mean, here's another kind of positive thing about this book. I mean, I think that we can go, I'm sure that, like, I can just let you loose for about 45 minutes about, you know, the way he treats Nietzsche. I think Nietzsche's sort of the productivity of Nietzsche's thought is not done enough justice in the book. In a different way to Marx, because Nietzsche gets more of a hearing than the actual Marx. But I think there's similar issues there. But I mean, I think the thing about this book is that I feel like all this incoherence also, I mean, it has certain advantages, right, in that he gets to treat, at least at this historical juncture, he gets to treat a lot of these anti-liberal movements and their internal contradictions. He gets to see them a lot more clearly, precisely, I think, because he's not wedded to an analytical framework. And he's in some sense closer to, like, the view of history that, like, someone like you might have, right? You know, you feel like there's a sort of understanding of the fact that these movements can contradict both internally and externally what they're opposed to, and the way that, you know, easy labels like nationalist or fascist can just, in the internal logic of one particular historical perspective, or one particular nation, can just mix with other elements to, you know, produce some really perverted monsters. I mean, the whole book is a story of how this happens. So in some way, this book is just this kind of, like, mirror image of this, of these really, really detailed books, right? In the absence of an analytical frame of some kind, right, we flip between incoherent big history and little case studies, right, with no kind of, like, meaningful synthesis. I mean, this is... You mentioned all the books which people could rather read, which would give a more detailed analysis of these movements. He cites a lot of them, right? Karl Lowith, Voegelin, all of these are kind of like more detailed versions of his arguments, right?
Isaiah Berlin for all the German and Russian reaction and counter-reaction,
right,
stuff. You know,
I mean,
he only wrote 12 books just on that.
I swear, he's, Berlin is also cited here. But, I mean, that's my point, right?
Yeah, he is. Edward Luce is The Retreat of Western Liberalism, which I don't think was written up, but Edward Luce is cited. But, yeah. I mean, like, this book is fertile for the amount of things that can have you look up.
Absolutely.
And it does give you a realistic sort of depiction of things like the Islamist movement and to a lesser degree, I think, Hinduvadism, although Hinduvadism, I think, is much lesser understood in the West. They just kind of think it's normal fascism and move on.
Right.
And it's really the only fascist analog would be Falangism in Spain.
Right.
And I'm not sure I consider Falangism truly fascist.
I mean, he explicitly says, right, Hindutva, you know, at least the main founder of Hindutva was not very keen on, you know, didn't think that politics had to be religious. He was scornful of the idea that you get divine sanction for political action.
Right. But at the same token, that's not where it's gone in the age of Modi or even before it.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, the any racialism in India right now, like they're claiming to be Indo-Europeans, but, you know, totally not from the steppes and all that, seems to be actually religiously motivated, not the other way
around. I mean, hey, we kill people for you know, maiming cows. Tell me that's got nothing to do with religion.
I get that Mishra's frustrations with secular thought right now, and I get his point about the hypocrisy of the Enlightenment, of the radical Enlightenment, but he doesn't deal with the fact that, let's be honest, Voltaire, the philosophes, and Rousseau are not the only strain of the Enlightenment at stake. He talks about Hegel and Kant, but doesn't talk about how they're actually critiquing the French philosophes. He talks about Nietzsche, but doesn't deal with the fact that Nietzsche actually sided with Voltaire. Explicitly, because he thought German nationalism was petty, and he sort of brings that up, but doesn't dwell on what it means.
Right.
Like, he doesn't see how Nietzsche is... He sees how Nietzsche's critiquing Wagner and critiquing the Enlightenment, but he doesn't really stay on the fact that Nietzsche's also critiquing, by proxy, Herder and Fichte, you know, in a way. Like, even if he's not mentioning them directly and he may not have even read them, he's critiquing that entire train of thought.
Right.
And in a weird way, Nietzsche actually agrees with Hegel about Napoleon. It's strange, but... You know, and he's anti-bourgeois, and Napoleon's Hegel's pro-bourgeois, and they both see Napoleon as a turning point in history for this. But at the same time, Mishra doesn't stay on. He, you know, even though his categorization of resentment is purely from Nietzsche, this whole framework of the book doesn't hold if you don't buy into Nietzsche's argument about resentment. But he doesn't talk about how, you know, this, none of this really holds up. And the other thing is, like, he doesn't deal with the fact that these ethno-nationalist movements they can't stay just ethno-nationalists. Like, Baathism and Khomeiniism can't tolerate each other, even though they're, like, if in a perfect ethno-nationalist localist world, there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to.
Right. I mean, he's gonna hand wave away all of these differences by talking about, well, that's, you know, hey, resentiment does bad stuff. But at that point, you got to ask, well, who is resentiment really explaining anything?
No, I mean, it just seems like cause people get resentful. They resent others, and they resent the fact that this was promised to do something and it doesn't do it.
Yeah.
They were sold a false bill of goods. Okay, great. And then a bunch of stuff, people react to that. Okay, great. But that's like a third grade argument, really.
I mean, like, the kernel of truth in that is the thing that is right is that we shouldn't treat these anti-modern movements as being, you know, textualists of some sort, right? So that's why the nihilism, or, you know, if we treat them as, you know, saying, okay, well, here's this, like, single religious framework, or here's this single ethical framework, which we can take all of these anti-modern movements as, you know, following. Then we've gotten them wrong. The nihilistic urge, or the sort of act-based foundation of this, like, I think that is important, but that on its own isn't going to get you anywhere.
Yeah, it's really not. And so let's cap this off, because we both really thought we were going to like this.
Oh, yeah.
I think part of the reason why we're so bitter is you and I both thought we're going to like this book.
I mean, like, I should say, says, I liked it. I liked reading it, but then I thought about it. And then...
See, I didn't like reading it because well, let me rephrase that. In the first 20 pages or 30 pages, I'm like, this is a good insight. This is a good insight. This is a good insight. Then I started being like, there's no argument here.
Right.
There's no argument here.
Right.
I literally took to page 132 for him to state his thesis on nationalism. which doesn't correspond exactly with what he described. I actually got very frustrated with him. I felt it was like the opposite of Naomi Klein. Like Naomi Klein and the Shock Doctrine, you know, which one completely mischaracterized Milton Friedman's 2000s positions. Like, he was anti-Bush and anti-the war and all this. Klein just ignores that, but also, like, talks about how literally over and over again, Mitterrand, the first pink wave in Latin America, the end of the Sandinistas, that they're all actually the people that neoliberalized more than Pinochet and the Chicago Boys could. And then at the end of that book, she's like, but we need more Keynesianism and less ideology and more practical. And I was just like, you literally told the story of how that failed every single time for 20 years. And somehow, because Milton Friedman is scary, that undoes all that failure. That means that it wasn't their fault.
Right.
And then I felt the same thing about this book. Like,
but the other way around.
It was very similar.
The other way around.
Yeah, but the other way around. Like this keeps on saying, well, you know, these resentments are bad, but can't you really see why you should really side with Rousseau? Because look at Rousseau. He sides with the poor Polish peasant. I mean, I know at the end of his life he becomes kind of a misogynist and thinks women should be subordinate to men and everybody should be subordinate to the will of the people, and the will of the people is whatever people feel. But, you know, doesn't he have a point, really, against Voltaire? I mean, and Rousseau does have a point against Voltaire. But the thing is, just having a point against who you're critiquing doesn't mean you're right. I mean, that's one of the things that's a bigger and bigger theme in my life lately, is people who are right about their enemies but fundamentally wrong about what they're defending when they're attacking their enemies.
Right.
And Mishra seems to be in that, and so much so that he almost seems to be making an argument that the age of anger, like that these people are not only legitimate in their anger, which I think can be argued. I mean, I actually sort of agree with that. But that this would be the only outcome it could possibly happen anyway, except for if we have more mediating institutions. But then I'm like, what are these mediating institutions supposed to be? Or is it like the medieval state system where there's like three different institutional separate hierarchies competing and thus mediating in competition?
I mean, it's not even that sophisticated. Mediating, all mediating institutions means for him is just like institutions which mediate like social conflict. But then that's any institution. That's any institution acts as a kind of space where you can, you know, talk and interact with you. That's sort of what institutions are. They have a mediating function. I mean, another thing to mention, I guess, before my kind of own closing remarks is that the entire sort of like post-Marxist tradition, and even large sections of the 20th century anarchist tradition, Simone Weil gets a little mention, but are just erased. I mean, I don't sound like Sadie Doyle or somebody, but it's just, yeah, there's just no mention of Sartre, Lukács, Adorno, the Frankfurt School, all of these people. I mean, particularly Adorno and Horkheimer, who you'd think that he should have a lot of time for. Right.
Yes, since they wrote The Dialectic of Enlightenment and, about exactly this problem.
And they, I mean, it's even giving him too much credit to say it's the same problem, right? Because he's much more the Adorno and Horkheimer thing, although you can have, I mean, I still think that book is a bit mystified. But like, that's way more on point than this stuff. I mean, it's way more like it's an objective critique. We can at least critique it while, you know, it's not this kind of hand-wavy exercise that we get from him. And of course, you know, he might say, well, who cares about Marxism? Well, you should. You're talking about critics of the Enlightenment, right? You're talking about movements in Western society and outside Western society, which have been influential in creating our current age of anger. And, you know, a movement which controlled a third of the world, or what is it, 60% of its inhabitants in the 20th century, something like that. Just kind of ignoring that, or kind of pushing it into, oh, well, that's just national liberation, or that's, you know, oh, that's just like Khomeini, or that's just like theology, oh, because some Marxism is just secularized theology, you know. It just seems to me to be, you know, I don't know what axe he has to grind, but it's just a complete kind of intellectual and political absence of the Marxist tradition and Marxist politics. It's just the big gap to me in this book. And it's not even like be more materialist. That's fine, right? You know, don't be materialist. Not everyone has to be, you know, not everyone has to do materialist explanation. You can do valuable work without being a materialist. But, you know, if what you're doing is doing history of ideas, talk about the right ideas. You know, anyway, yeah.
Or actually, you know, sustain a genealogy. Like, pick case studies and stick with them. Like, if you do something on nationalism, Manzini, and its influence on third worldism, and stick with it. You know, the other person that he really avoids talking about, that, and even though he mentions people who use language from this movement, is Maoism.
Right, right.
He doesn't mention Maoism, even though he calls, you know, he cites people calling Rushdie and Naipaul compradores, which is Latin American Maoism. And actually, as I said in my commentary, actually, that was the moment where I turned on the book, like, unequivocally. I was like, oh, God. Because that's how Maoists used to justify class collaborationism within a national context, is because the comprador class was internationalist and imperialism was a greater contradiction. And he just does not want to bring that up at all. And how can you be writing about Asia and all these people picking up on Leninism and Maoism and never mention Maoism? I mean, he mentions Mao Zedong's thought like in passing, but he doesn't really dig into it at all. Like, how do you not mention that even in regards to Nehru?
Right.
And India's response / reaction to it. I mean, the other thing is, you get this weird feeling that he wants to have his cake and eat it too on India. Like, he almost, like, one of the reasons he doesn't talk about Nehru much, except a little bit about his relationship to Western philosophical societies and whatnot, is that he kind of, at one point, he says India's organic model, you know, like, he wants to defend the Indian model of development.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Did you pick that up?
No, because I think I must have skipped over it. But yeah, no, I mean, I wouldn't be... That fits in perfectly with the rest of the book.
And it fits in perfectly with his other books.
Yeah.
His books on Buddhism and his books on the temptations of the West.
Yeah.
I mean, this book is an expansion of those two books, but it's much less coherent. But, you know, he talks about how he's fascinated with Russian and German thinkers. And, I mean, like, that makes sense. And the book is most lucid when he's writing about Rousseau and Voltaire, are the relationship between Herder, Fichte, Gorbanou, and, you know, the tension between the idealists and the romantics. But he doesn't really deal with the fact that, you know, idealism also has a romantic sort of conception, because it's responding to, in some ways, English and French rationalism and trying to critique it. And he kind of just, when he talks about like Hegel and Kant, he kind of presents them as like just a pure continuation of the philosophes program.
Which they weren't, as anyone would tell you, yeah.
Right. But, I mean, he doesn't say that, but he puts them so squarely on the side of the Enlightenment that, and they kind of were, but he doesn't deal with the fact that they're critiquing the French version of the Enlightenment. Like, explicitly.
I mean, and in Hegel, you could argue, is like at least a conflicted defender of Enlightenment, much more conflicted than Kant was.
Right. And I think, like, if you talk about, for example, he doesn't talk about this, but, like, for example, Schopenhauer, who's, you know, anti-Enlightenment, is still kind of like, he's almost a pure Kantian.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he talks about Schopenhauer as just kind of like, well, Europe got pessimistic, and then people started believing in Schopenhauerian nihilism. Nothing about his nothing about his politics or anything. Yeah,
and nothing about Schopenhauer's politics, and nothing about how Schopenhauer was methodologically a Kantian.
Absolutely,
like,
yeah.
I wanted to take out Isaiah Berlin on one hand, and then this scholar who writes so much about the German Enlightenment.
Beiser, Fred Beiser.
Beiser on the other, and beat Mishra with it. Like, because he's like almost there, but he's so not dealing with what else is going on. And one thing, if you get Beise and you read After Hegel, which is a book we should probably talk about in detail.
Yeah, sometime. I'd love to. I mean, it might not be that problematic as along the way to get Beise on the podcast.
Because Beise points out about the institutional pressures of particularly during German unification of justifying philosophy that led to problems that those of us who look at the university now in America would recognize, and that philosophy had to move away from its metaphysical and political justifications and move into practical and scientific ones immediately. And even though it's an intellectual history and he's not actually trying to be materialist, he actually gives materialist reasons and systemic reasons for why this happened. And Mishra doesn't seem to think any of that's important.
Right.
Right. I mean, this is where I am going to agree with you, but I want people to get why we're saying this. This is not just, oh, the normal Marxist. It's not materialist enough. Blah, 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 blah. Because ideas, although I'm also talking about ideas. But, like, there's specific contextual things he's not dealing with.
Right.
Why is corruption so endemic in North Africa? Well, he doesn't go into how the Ottomans structured the canton system and how these groups didn't have enough money to pay for their armies. And they didn't have enough resources yet either. You know, and he doesn't go into how Islamism was made much more attractive by the discovery of oil in Arabia. And how this has led to, I mean, like, he also doesn't discuss, this is amazing, he talks about Islamism all the time, and he talks about Salafism. He doesn't mention Wahhabism ever. Does right. he? I don't remember a single reference to Saudi Arabia in this.
I mean, and, you know, Indian, the Deobandis, and all, you know, the Taliban, he doesn't talk about them either.
No, he talks about Al-Qaeda and ISIS, although he doesn't ever mention ISIS-specific thinkers. But he talks a lot about Al-Awlaki because he, you know, cites Solzhenitsyn and is obviously educated.
But it's also right? Al-Awlaki is current. There's like, you know, you can, oh, that's the guy who got killed by the drone.
Right, and he mentions, you know, the Al-Qaeda bombers who were tied to McVeigh and who became friends with him in the Supermax prison. And McVeigh's own response to having to kill people, you know, what he saw was murder people in Iraq.
Right.
I mean, and these are things where, like, he's almost there. And I think that has, for example, a lot of people, right, a lot of people on the alt-right feel betrayed by Trump because of Trump's concession on military policy.
Right.
And I don't mean like the alt-right who, I mean the true, like the true hardcore basically Nazis.
Right. And you know, I'm sure you have a bit like we on the left have gone through this many times. You guys get a taste of your own. Yeah.
So they don't know what to do. I mean, the left doesn't know what to do with that either because they're like, wait, yeah, you guys are anti-war? Yeah, they are. They've always been.
Yeah.
They hate brown people, but they're isolationist.
Right.
You know, and it really shakes things up. You know, I do think there are a lot of... Another thing about this book is it's obviously aimed about critiques of America and calls into neoconservatism's, you know, Islamophobia and whatever. But he doesn't actually talk about America hardly at all. He does talk about how Alan Bloom at one point was aware of the contradictions of some of what he was pointing out, but couldn't go deep enough into it and ended up defending neoconservatism. But that's as much as he really goes into the United States.
Right.
And that it's also like the elephant in the room because he's critiquing the U.S.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess so. Just to wrap up on my side, I suppose, for just a kind of final thought about the book, The question that I'd like to press, both I suppose for myself and for people who might be interested in this book, is that you've obviously heard that both of us are very annoyed and disappointed with the book, and we expected a lot more out of it. But the key question that I guess we have to think about is that what would our alternative to this look like? Because the compelling bit of this is we do want to tell a story, not simply about these individual groups and giving systemic, detailed, local accounts of how individual reactionary anti-modern movements come up, but a sort of systematic story of where of the sort of general global forces that are leading these anti-modern movements to come up. I think we should want to tell that story. And it's become clear that telling that story in terms of vague appeals to psychology or whatever isn't going to work. But we've also, over a long, you know, 2-year history of podcasting, figured out why, you know, standard, we've talked again and again about how standard Marxist historiography can't deal with the complexities of these movements. So I guess the question that I want to press is that, okay, how do we do Mishra better, so to speak?
Well, you actually sustain these arguments and you look at the longer history of how they're interrelated. You dig into how Leninism really did affect these movements. You dig into how and why Ba'athism and Nasserism and to some reason, and it's interesting. Did you notice that even though he talks about Ataturk and Turkey, that he doesn't talk about Erdogan?
No, he doesn't. I mean, he mentions him, but that's not... He doesn't talk about the relationship between them. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He doesn't talk about Erdogan's relationship to the notion of a secular Turkey. He doesn't talk about, you know, he doesn't talk about Turkey, like, in the 20th century very much. And the coups and all of that, you know, the Erdogan, Ataturk to Erdogan, he doesn't talk at all about that progression.
So we would have to actually do that and sustain it, and you couldn't select details. That you wouldn't make this argument by analogy. You would make this argument by a mixture of empirical research and tracing genealogical ideas and then seeing where the material backgrounds are different and contrasting them. And so it is not a book. It is a series of books.
Right.
If you want to do this right.
Right.
You can't say you're going to write about the Age of Anger, which is really, you know, everything from the 17th century forward in response to the Enlightenment, and not think about how massive that task actually is. I mean, in a way, the task he sets himself is impossible.
Right.
So that's what you do. And I mean, I do think if you're going to read this kind of like a day book of let me get these interesting ideas that I should be reading from other people, it's a great way to read this book. You will get all kinds of things you should probably go off and read. But what you'll find is that if you do that, you'll realize that Mishra doesn't really have an argument. And in so much that he does have an argument, it's based on equivocations of saying this is this and this is this. And I'm not going to explicitly state that this is this and this is this. I'm just going to pair these together so you can implicitly put it together so you can't call out my argument. Which is why argument by analogous comparisons is probably the weakest form of argument.
Right. Yeah, I mean that's all that I've got to say. Unless you've got anything, yeah. Anything.
No, nope, I don't want to sound more hateful on it. I do think, read the book, and then read the notes on your favorite chapters, and find out the books he's referencing, and go read them when you're interested in it. And I will say, the one thing I do think that Mishra is good at is getting Westerners to, quote, take India more seriously beyond just reading Spivak and, you know, the Indian post-colonialist and the response to them, like Chivers. I mean, like, which I actually tend to agree with Chivers, but read the history of India and deal with it because it's much more complicated than the way that a lot of liberals in America will kind of selectively quote Gandhi. All right, nothing more to say.